young whippersnappers out there. I don't know if you're ready for this, but here comes the colonel.
Wherever do these creeps come from? I mean, golly. It's not funny. It's not funny. All right. Welcome back. The second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow on the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. Exciting show today. We're going to get back with Corey Henderstein in just a minute, the vice president of the Nuclear Threat Initiative. The worry about securing the world's plutonium, since Russia has a good part of it. That's the weapons-grade stuff. And since Putin right now is crosswise with, it seems, the rest of the civilized world. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. But right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we keep here on the set. Rummage around in the coin jar just a little bit here. And today's...
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I...
I see. We just throw in a few coins. And, of course, the greedy old spirit of the fountain is awakened, because he knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all for price. All right, oh spirit of the fountain. Here is a geography question for you. This one should be quite easy. You should know this real, real easy. Mount Robson. That's the highest peak in the Canadian Rockies. And it's located in what Canadian province, O Spirit of the Fountain? Mount Robson, the highest peak in the Canadian Rockies. What province is it located in?
I have given you my answer. And now you may tell the
Aha! The Spirit of the Fountain knows all and hears all and sees all. And you probably guessed this one, too. This is a pretty easy one. The highest peak in the Canadian Rockies, Mount Robson, is located in what Canadian province? If you said British Columbia, you are absolutely correct. All right, back to today's guest. Okay, back in the line with Corey Henderstein, the vice president of the Nuclear Threat Initiative. When we left her the last half hour, we were worried about what to do with all the weapons-grade plutonium laying around.
Yeah, and then I believe you said something about using the weapons-grade, the plutonium and that sort of thing, mixing it down and having it be sent to other countries such as Germany. But that led me to believe that this is this process is taking place in places like France. Is that what you said?
So there are a few countries that are actually doing the separation of the plutonium. Mm. France is one. Russia is one. India is one. Japan has built a massive facility. It's not running at commercial scale yet, but their facility will be separating plutonium if they decide to operate it as planned. And so France is actually the biggest country that takes in other people's used fuel, separates the plutonium, and then sends the plutonium in the form of this mixed oxide fuel, this MOX fuel, back to the country that provided it. So they have a number of countries that are their customers.
All right, but France isn't alone in the doing of it. But that leads me to the other question. I mean, if transportation of this material is a concern, as it has been in the United States, of transporting it to Yucca Mountain, plutonium is transported then to France and to India and to Japan and other places by, I suppose, ship or rail or some manner or that sort of thing. And that has to be protected and guarded in the shipment too, right?
It does. And this is where it's important that we talk about how to make the material as the least vulnerable that it can be at any given point, you know, in this chain. And so when you talk about plutonium, the plutonium is most vulnerable when it is separated by itself in its own in a quantity that's just that's pure plutonium. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about plutonium in the civil cycle, we try to have it be at that stage as little time as possible and not be transported around. So, for example, when France separates the plutonium, they relatively immediately fabricate it back into this mixed oxide fuel. What that does is, instead of having, you know, a softball size amount of plutonium, you now have plutonium that's in a fuel rod or a fuel assembly that may be 10, 12, 14 meters long. So now you're not talking about something that could be stashed in a backpack. You're talking about a real major effort to try to get a fuel assembly and divert it and steal it. So there are things you can do at various points along the way. Then you also have to rely on the responsibility of the industry. And some people trust the nuclear industry and some don't. But, for example, the France, UK, and Japan came together quite a few years ago and created something called the World Nuclear Transport Institute that was originally just focused on the safe and secure transport of these, of both the used fuel and the fresh fuel going back to the customer. And it had to do with, you know, describing the important safety and security measures that would have to be taken for those countries to ship this material around the world. The fact of the matter is this material is going around the world on a regular basis. I mean, it just is. And so what we have to do is make sure that if it's going to be transported, it's transported as little as possible, minimal transport. And then when we get to those points at which the material will be transported, we have to have the best possible practices with regard to safety and security of the material.
Yeah, when countries transport it, of course, their military is doing the transporting, and that must be kind of a delicate thing because, of course, France doesn't have all the plutonium, so it's got to be transported to France. I presume that it's military that's transporting these things, and in Russia, plutonium then is not being transported out of Russia. This process is taking place in Russia without moving the plutonium out of Russia. Is that what we're saying?
Right, so Russia and India are both examples of countries that do their own internal fuel cycles. They have their own used fuel. They have reprocessing programs. Russia is using MOX. India is pursuing that technology, is not a user of it, widely at this point. You know, some of this is our domestic programs, some of them are international programs, but I do want to just reiterate, this is not plutonium being shipped around the world in its pure form, and it's not coming out of nuclear weapons. The nuclear weapons plutonium that, you know, we talked about in the context of the South Carolina facility, that's one particular program where disarmament, the elimination of U.S. nuclear weapons, thousands of them, has resulted in this quantity of plutonium, and the United States is looking at burning that in civil reactors as a way to eliminate it, to get rid of this, to both make the disarmament irreversible as part of a joint commitment that we made with Russia for the elimination of their nuclear weapons as well as to eliminate the terrorist threat. So that's one very unique area. The rest that we've been talking about is all material that is coming out of nuclear power plants, civil nuclear power plants. And that means that this is all in the general utility sector. This is a business. And so we do need to have some impact on those business decisions. And policymakers need to decide the rules and the terms of those business, of how those businesses can operate. But this is not nuclear weapons material coming out of nuclear weapons or intended for nuclear weapons.
All right, so we have two important things then that we have to focus on, and right now our agreement for scaling down our nuclear weapons on our end, we're not keeping the agreement because we still have all that plutonium, but Russia is getting rid of their plutonium and putting it in this mix you're talking about. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the weapons plutonium has not yet been eliminated in Russia either. They are building a whole new facility to burn this weapons plutonium, and where they are doing it is on their civil side from their nuclear power plants. They are burning that plutonium, you know, putting that back into, they're separating it first and then putting it back into power plants. It's important that we recognize that the only one-way, you know, trip for plutonium is if it comes out of weapons. All the other plutonium we're talking about is being created and then separated and used again, and then created and separated and used. There isn't naturally occurring plutonium. So there's no obligation of states to actually burn this plutonium, because if you don't separate it, you don't have to burn it.
Yeah.
So we have this, right now we have one inventory of material, the stuff that's coming out of dismantled nuclear weapons, and we have to figure out what to do with that. Separately, we have a civil power program that's operating in, you know, many countries all over the world, and they're making decisions. Should they separate some plutonium and then burn it again as fuel or not? And we would argue that the best choice is to not separate it. We just should dispose of the fuel with the plutonium still in the used fuel in the mixture of all of these transuranic elements that were produced in the nuclear power plant.
Okay, so then is it your insight or your hunch that that facility in South Carolina probably will never be built?
I think that the South Carolina facility has an uphill battle right now, and mostly it's because it's a hugely expensive facility, and right now the Department of Energy is looking to say, can we meet the obligations we have with Russia, that is, to mutually eliminate nuclear weapons and some set of nuclear weapons and then irreversibly get rid of the material that was in them. Can we do that another way? And there are some other ways you can do it. One way is called vitrification. You actually mix the plutonium into a glass matrix, and you create vitrified plutonium, and then you put those in cans, and you put the cans in canisters, and you can dispose of them. You can put those in long-term disposal underground. So that's another option. And at early on in the program, this plutonium disposition program, the United States was actually following both those tracks to see whether the plutonium MOX program, the South Carolina facility, or this vitrification program would be the one that they would choose. And eventually they chose the MOX program. But because of the huge inflation of the cost of that and other concerns, they are going back and seeing whether one of those two options is the right one or if there maybe is a third way.
All right. Well, give us a peek about what happened in The Hague. I mean, there were, 50 heads of state there to prevent nuclear terrorism at the Nuclear Security Summit, and you were there. Give us a picture. What went on?
Well, the summit in The Hague was really a remarkable meeting, and it's the third Nuclear Security Summit, and there will be a fourth in 2016 that will come to the United States. The first one was in 2010 in Washington, D.C., and the second one was 2012. In Seoul, South Korea. And what we've seen through these summits, there are 53 heads of government or their very senior ministers meeting to actually develop a global agenda for the security of nuclear weapons material and the prevention of nuclear terrorism. This is an issue that just wasn't on the global agenda before 2010, which is shocking to think about. Considering the global consequences of a nuclear terrorist attack, and we think about what happened to the global economy and airline transportation, tourism, banking, everything else after 9/11, and magnify that by a few times if there will be a nuclear terrorist attack. So the first important thing that's come out of this summit process is a bit of a coalition on the threat, that there really is a nuclear terrorist threat, it's real and it's urgent, and there are steps we can take to address it. Then you think about what can countries do. And this summit really went the furthest of any of them in setting a future agenda where states are not only making concrete commitments, not just saying it would be nice to do something, but actually saying what they're going to do and that they're going to be accountable to each other for doing it. And to look towards 2016 as a point at which we actually start talking about a global system for the security of nuclear materials. And, from NTI's perspective, we think to be effective, that system has to be comprehensive, meaning it has to cover all nuclear materials, whether it's civil nuclear materials or materials and weapons. After all, 85% of nuclear materials in the world are in the non-civil sector. They're in military sectors. We think the system has to be based on best practices and enforced standards. Mm-hmm. We think the system has to be based on the minimization as much as possible of all nuclear materials, so that you have as little as possible in as few locations as possible. So we think these are the elements of a system, and fundamentally, those elements need to be based on this concept that it's not enough for any state just to say, it's my sovereign responsibility and trust me. That's where we had been up until really the last couple of years. Instead, you have to say, it is my responsibility. But part of that responsibility is I have to demonstrate to you what I'm doing. I have to show you that I'm securing my material to the greatest extent possible. And there are a number of ways that you can do that, but includes everything from peer reviews of security arrangements to bilateral or multilateral security partnerships. And this is the direction that the world is going, and the Hague Summit really was the biggest step forward so far.
Well, I have to ask you, of the 53 heads of state that were there, I guess Vladimir Putin was not among them?
That's correct. President Putin was not at the summit. He was. Russia was represented by Foreign Minister Lavrov, this is. It's unfortunate because Russia obviously is a huge player with regard to nuclear material. They not only have a large infrastructure, but they have the most material of any country in the world. The U.S. and Russia are the, you know, the leaders in the clubhouse on that issue. But it's not, also not. It's not by itself a bad sign in the sense that many other countries, for various reasons, were represented by their by people at the ministerial level, at their foreign minister or their defense ministers or energy ministers.
And tell me, was Iran represented there?
Iran is not a summit country. They have not been invited to the summit. And they are one of the few countries that actually has some of the material of concern, this highly enriched uranium or plutonium. They do have some highly enriched uranium that's left over from their old research program, but they were not represented at the summit.
Well, Corey, I got to ask you, is any of the concerns of the Nuclear Threat Initiative concerning things like the Stuxnet worm that allegedly attacked the Iranian nuclear program back a few years ago?
Well, certainly the intersection of cyber threat and nuclear security is of interest to us at NTI, and we just like many in the community are just starting to think about whether and how we can be helpful in thinking through potential measures that could reduce the risks of not just a cyber use for sabotage, which is how some would describe the Stuxnet worm, but also the interaction between the physical security systems on site at facilities and cyber threats. So one could think about a cyber attack being something that by itself leads to the release of radiation by sabotaging a facility. One could also think about the cyber threat as something which maybe disables a security system that then allows somebody on the ground to have access to an area that they might not have otherwise had access to. So this is certainly an area of nuclear security for the future.
And do we yet know who the perpetrator was of the Stuxnet worm?
I think that there has been a lot in the press that has speculated and about the Stuxnet worm and where and its origins, but I don't think any country has officially claimed credit.
Or blame, for that matter. Okay. So with all this security necessary, is there a... I guess the military is doing a bit part of it, but you'd also mentioned civilian security firms that are doing this too. Is there an increased demand for more security firms to guard these things?
Well, I think that when we think about security and the demand for security, it's much more about thinking about security as a broader responsibility. So this isn't just about who your guard force is. And as you say, a lot of the guard forces are actually, civilian contractors in the United States. In other countries, they might be militaries or police kind of special police. But security is more than just the guards, the guns, and the gates. Security has to be institutional arrangements, starting from whether it's the board of directors or the head of a national lab or going all the way up to the president and the prime minister, which is the reason why the summits have been so important. It has to be about security culture where everybody involved in the enterprise recognizes that there is a threat, that them doing their job correctly matters in reducing that threat, and that any lapse in kind of vigilance could result in something that could be catastrophic. And so this has to do with the person checking the pass at the front door, but it also has to do with the person who knows that they have to remember their pass every day and not be annoyed when they're asked to show it. It's at all levels of the organization, and security has to be a mission that is equal to safety and environmental stewardship in any organization that manages material that could be used for a nuclear weapon.
Well, Corey, can you maybe give us a look down the road a little bit? I mean, at this summit and other things that you've learned and studied for a bit. I mean, 5 years, 10 years, 15. What do you see in the future for this subject?
Well, looking to the future, I think what we want to see in 2016 is a nuclear summit that starts to put the forward agenda in more concrete terms. And then what I mean by that is nuclear security and the broad international nuclear security architecture has to be in place so that we don't need a summit every 2 years to get the presidents to pay attention. It just has to be integrated as part of our national security as well as our institutional and organizational perspective if we work at facilities and we manage facilities that have nuclear material. That's the short term. That's the 2 year. The long term is we have to think about the role that this material plays and think about whether in any case where there is nuclear material, do we have options? And so that means how many nuclear weapons do we have and do we need them all? If we don't, then we need to be dismantling and eliminating that material. Where it's used in civil commerce, for example, highly enriched uranium has been used for a long time to produce medical isotopes. That has a great benefit, but at the same time, we now realize we can have that same benefit without using the highly enriched uranium, and there's a massive effort underway internationally to convert all those processes that use highly enriched uranium to no longer use that material. That just takes something out of the equation. It takes out completely from an area where we need to. So we don't need to secure the material if we're not using it. So the longer-term discussion is, why do we use this material, and do we have other options?
Okay, so there are no pat answers to these questions. The thing is, we have to visit these things and study these things and pay attention to what's going on in this particular field every day, every week, all the time. We may not need a summit every 2 years. Right now, we're going to get one. The next one you said, I think you said, was going to be in the United States. I don't know why. I had heard something about Milan. I heard that Italy was releasing a bunch of their nuclear material and that Milan might be the next site. But it's going to be in the United States. Is that right?
Going to be the United States. The Italians did give up some of their nuclear material as part of a commitment under the Nuclear Security Summit, but the summit itself is going to be in the United States.
Corey Hinderstein, the Vice President of National Programs for the Nuclear Threat Initiative Efforts. So good of you to be with us today. Thank you so very much to be generous with your time.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
We absolutely should not take no for an answer. Perhaps in the context of this discussion, people that say, I'm not going to share information about security because it's country-specific and I don't want to share that with other people. I think we should not accept that. I think it's much, much better to overcome that barrier and share information. And so not taking no for an answer is, I think, very important. It is absolutely imperative that we do things together. And seeking that collaboration with other people is, I think, paramount if you want to be successful and happy in life. It's Anno Keizer, and I am head of group security of Urenco, one of the major uranium enrichment companies.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.